All right, so in verse 17, he said, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I'm not come to destroy, but to fulfill." And last week we talked about how they had already accused him of breaking the Sabbath on a couple of different occasions. And so here he makes it very clear that he did not come to destroy the law, to annihilate it or to demolish it, but instead he came to fulfill the law. Now, last week we also looked at the fact that he did come and he did abolish the law, the Old Testament law. He did nail it to the cross. He did bring it to fulfillment. And verse 18, "For truly I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled." And that's an important part of that verse, till all be fulfilled. Of course, that's exactly what Christ did. He fulfilled the law. He fulfilled the prophecies that were spoken concerning him. He came and he did what his purpose was to do. He fulfilled the law. He brought it to an end, so to speak. It was abolished. It was nailed to the cross. And of course, today we live under New Testament law, the New Testament. But verse 19 is an interesting verse. "Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." Every part of God's law is to be followed. That was true under the Old Testament law, and of course it's true under the New Testament law. Now, break here in this verse means in the Greek word actually is lousi, and it means to loose or to relax. And in fact, it's the same word as Mark chapter 1 and verse 7. You don't have to turn there, but that's where I believe it's where John the Baptist, Mark chapter 1 and verse 7, said, "There's coming one mightier than I after me, the latchet of whose shoes I am not worthy to stoop down and to unloose." And so that's the same word there, to unloose. So he says, "Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments," and the word literally means to loose or to relax. So anyone who looses or relaxes even a least commandment by breaking that commandment or by teaching shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. And so we have no authority to loosen even the smallest command. And that's important to think about as we continue to study. We have no authority to loosen even the smallest command. We have no authority to break those commands ourselves. And we have no authority to teach others to loosen those commands. Every command is to be followed.
Do you not think this ties back into the old law then, Paul? I've had questions about this.
Yeah, but I think it would apply to both. He's saying the law is important. He didn't come to demolish the law. He came to fulfill the law. And the law has always been important. Whether you lived under the Old Testament, you were to keep the law to the best of your ability. You live in the New Testament today. You are to keep the law. I think the principle would apply to both the Old Testament as well as the New Testament law. Because he's also speaking to the church. He's speaking to, he's speaking regarding this new kingdom. So I think it would apply to both. Certainly the principle would apply to both. Do we need to keep every law today? Do we need to keep all the laws of God? All the commands of God today? Certainly we do. Right. Right. No, not the Mosaic law. But the law that we live under today, the New Testament law. Today, he's about to speak about divorce and remarriage, right? Does that apply to us today? So he's not just speaking about Old Testament law. He's also looking forward. And he's making some basic statements that I think apply to both. Anybody have anything to add to that? So whosoever shall lose one of the least commandments and shall teach men, so shall he be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Turn over to the book of James, if you would, real quick. Is it important that we keep all of God's law? First of all, do we live under law today? Some would say we don't live under law today. Do we live under law today? What law do we live under?
Under the law of Christ. Not the Mosaic law, but the law that Jesus laid down the prophets.
Right. James chapter 2. In verse 8, he says, if you fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, you do well. That's found in Leviticus 19 and verse 18. But if you have respect to persons, you commit sin and are convinced of the law as transgressors. For whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point is guilty of all. For he that said, do not commit adultery, said also, do not kill. Now if you commit no adultery, yet if you kill, you are become a transgressor of the law. So speak ye, and so do, as they that shall be judged by the law of liberty. We will be judged by the law of liberty. We live under the law of liberty. Chapter 1 and verse 25, it says, whosoever looketh into the perfect law of liberty and continueth therein, being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed. So in chapter 2, what does he mean there? Whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point is guilty of all. What is he basically saying there in verse 10? If we break one of God's laws, are we guilty of breaking all of his laws? I don't think that's what he's saying there. Or were you going to say something? Or are you just wiping your hair? If we're going to follow God's law, we need to follow all of his law.
I think another thing he's trying to teach us there is there's no difference between breaking, doing something we consider, man considers a horrible sin, mm-hmm. as opposed to telling a lie. Murder, we would consider murder worse than telling a lie. Mm-hmm. So there's no difference between in God's eyes. One break one, you've broken the whole law.
Right. Their problem in chapter 2 is they were being respecter of persons. And he's saying you're committing sin just because you keep all the other laws and yet you treat people wrong. You're a respecter of persons. You're still a law breaker is what he's saying here. The same God that said do not commit adultery also said do not kill. At the end of verse 11, if you kill, you are become a transgressor of the law. You are a law breaker. So we are to keep all of God's law. We can't just pick and choose. Because if we say, well, I'm going to follow almost all of his laws, but I don't want to follow this one, then guess what? You're a law breaker.
It's like a stain on the white sheet. If you sin,
it's there. Yeah. So go back to Matthew. Chapter 5 and verse 19. So we see here that Jesus cared about even the minutest detail of the law. Every jot, every tittle was to be preserved. We see that in verse 18. He cared about obedience to the minutest detail. No one has authority to violate or to teach others to violate, even the minutest detail. I think this is an important point here, that Jesus cares about the law and cares that it be followed, even to the minutest detail. Nobody has authority to violate or to teach others to violate, even the minutest detail. And he says those who do will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Now, in Harkrider's commentary that Tom gave me, he says that least in the kingdom means that they basically that they have no place at all. But I'm not sure if that's what he means there. But those who do will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them will be called great in the kingdom. Notice that do comes before teaching. We need to do God's law, follow his law. And then we are to teach God's law. Do the commandments of God and then teach others to do the same. So those who do not keep the law will be seen as least by the faithful in the kingdom. Those who keep the law will be seen as great. Now, ultimately, what will happen to those who don't keep the commandments of God? In the end, what will ultimately become of those who do not keep the commandments of God? Look at Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13, beginning in verse 41, the Son of Man shall send forth his angels, they shall gather out of his kingdom all the things that offend, and them which do iniquity or practice sin, and shall cast them into a furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who has ears to hear, let him hear. He has ears to hear, let him hear. Look at chapter 5 now, verse 20. He says, "For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." This must have been a shocking statement to them. And why would that be? Right. The scribes and the Pharisees, they were the religious elite, right? I mean, people looked up to them. You wanted to be as righteous as they were. They were the leaders. They were the teachers. The scribes were specifically the leaders and teachers of the Pharisaic sect. And they were recognized authorities concerning the law. But their righteousness was, how would you describe their righteousness? Artificial?
Shallow.
What's that? Show?
Shallow?
Outward only?
Ceremonial?
Did Jesus ever call them hypocrites? In chapter 23, he scolds them very badly, right? Calls them hypocrites over and over. We can't be like them. We have to be clean on the inside as well as on the outside. We need to make sure that we are the genuine thing, that we're not fakes, that we're not pretending, that we're not just show, that we're not just going through the motions. We need to make sure that we're not just righteous in public, but all the time, even in private. And we need to make sure that we're sincere, that our worship, that our obedience is heartfelt and it's not just merely actions. And he's going to go on to describe how they were doing that in many ways, beginning in verse 21. Somebody go ahead and read verses 21 through 26, if you would. 21 through 26. Hans, can you get that?
Okay. You have heard that has been said by them of old time, "Thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, Thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and then rememberest that thy brother has aught against thee, leave therefore thy gift before the altar and go thy way, first to be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, while thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou shalt be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing."
Okay. So again, in verse 21, "You have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment." Murder, of course, was prohibited under the law. Exodus 20 and verse 13, "Thou shalt not kill." It's not talking about, it's talking about murder. They're taking innocent life, shedding innocent blood. And the penalty for murder was death, Exodus 21 and verse 12. But it appears that the law had been altered by men in the past. Those who killed, notice here, were in danger of the judgment. In other words, they could be brought before the tribunal, the lower courts. But in verse 22, Jesus says, "But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, Thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire." Now the scribes and the Pharisees had twisted the law to suit themselves, and they had added their traditions and enforced their interpretation of the law. And so Jesus here is making a contrast with what they have taught. And now Jesus is saying, "But I say unto you." So think about that. He's saying, "I say unto you." And so he's speaking with authority. And he's going to do that throughout this sermon several times. He's going to make reference to what has been said, and then he's going to say, "But I say unto you." In verse 27, he says, "You have heard that it was said of them of old time, Thou shalt not commit adultery." But then in verse 28, he's going to say, "But I say unto you." He's going to go deeper into that. In chapter 5 and verse 31, it has been said, "Whosoever shall put his wife, weigh his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement." Verse 32, "But I say unto you." And so he'll give his word, his authority concerning those things. In verse 33, again, "You have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, Thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shall perform unto the Lord thine oaths." And then verse 34, "But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool." And he goes on and he does that several times. In verse 38, "You have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." In verse 43, "You have heard that it hath been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you," in verse 44. So Jesus here is speaking with the ultimate authority, with absolute supreme authority, when he says, "But I say unto you." And the people that listen, they recognize that he's teaching with authority. And in fact, if you look at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, look at chapter 7, verses 28 and 29. There it says, "It came to pass when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine." Why? "For he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes." So he's teaching with authority. "You have heard these things, but I say unto you." So they were teaching that those who kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But Jesus gives a deeper spiritual meaning here to the law. Jesus goes back and he's not just dealing with the act itself, but he's dealing with their thought process, their thinking that led up to it, that underlies the act. Because murder is the result of a murderous spirit. Murder is the result of a murderous attitude. And it begins with anger. It begins with hatred. Hold your place here. Look at 1 John chapter 3 and verse 15. First John 3 and verse 15, "Whosoever hateth his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him." Now go back, look again now at Matthew chapter 5. In verse 22, Jesus here gives three levels of attitude here. He talks about anger, and then getting to the point where you say "reka," which basically means empty head or calling somebody stupid. So not only are you angry, but now you're adding contempt to that anger. And then going even beyond that and calling somebody a fool, which basically implies that they have been abandoned by God. So you have anger, and then reka, and then thou fool. And then notice he gives three levels of punishment here to go with each one. He talks about the judgment, and that's talking about the lower courts, the tribunals. And then he talks about the council, which would be the higher court. That would be the Sanhedrin. And then ultimately, hell fire or Gehenna fire. So notice again, whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, speaking of the lower courts. Whosoever say to his brother, Reka, shall be in danger of the council. That's the higher court, the Sanhedrin. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire or Gehenna fire. Where does that name Gehenna come from? Does anybody know? The word Gehenna comes from the Valley of Hinnom, which was outside of Jerusalem. Yeah, basically a garbage dump. It was devoted to Moloch, a false god, and it was basically a smoldering garbage dump. So just imagine this dump out there, and it's constantly burning, it's constantly smoldering, and there's smoke rolling off of it all the time. When people were put to death for murder, they were thrown in the Valley of Gehenna. And so you can see where that image comes from. So notice here that sin has its stages, but God takes notice at the earliest stage. Where does our sin begin? We don't just instantly go out and murder somebody. We don't instantly go out and commit adultery. Where does it all begin? It begins in the mind. It begins in the heart. And that's, you know, rather than just, if you do this, you do this, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, Jesus is going to the heart of the matter. He's going literally to the heart, to the mind, and wanting to stop it there. Look at Matthew chapter 12. Go ahead, Bill.
That's the big difference between the old law and the new law.
Right.
The old law bound actions.
Right.
You could hate your brother all you wanted to as long as you didn't kill him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but you can talk bad about him, you can be angry with him, I guess. But the new law says that you can't do that.
Yeah.
Not their minds, and therefore, by controlling our minds, we have a better chance of controlling our actions.
Right. In Matthew chapter 12, verses 34 and 35, our conduct originates in the heart. There it says, O generation of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. A good man out of the good treasure of the heart brings forth good things, and the evil man out of the evil treasure bringeth forth evil things. What's in your heart, what's in your mind, is what's going to come out of your mouth and what's going to show in your actions. I think I've said this before. If you have a filthy mouth, then you have a filthy mind. You're a filthy person. You do bad things. Where are those bad things coming from? They're coming from a bad heart. They're coming from a bad mind. Hostile feelings can lead to hostile actions, and that's the point that he's making here. Look at verses 23 and 24 again. Or back to 23 and 24. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Notice it says, therefore. So therefore points back. Do our thoughts and our actions hinder our relationship with God? Does it hinder our worship to God? Absolutely. It did under the Old Testament law, and of course, under the New Testament law as well. Look at 1 John chapter 4. In verse 20. 1 John 4 and verse 20. If a man say, I love God, and hateth his brother, he is a liar. For he that loveth not his brother whom he hath seen, how can he love God whom he hath not seen? And this commandment have we from him, that he who loveth God loveth his brother also. It's so important that we love our brothers and sisters in Christ, and that we have that right relationship with them. Because if we don't, we can't have a right relationship with God. So make things right with your brother. In verse 25, he says, agree with your adversary quickly while you are in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. So he says to agree with one another. Be well disposed toward him is literally the meaning there. Your attitude toward him will affect his attitude toward you. The word adversary here means accuser, someone who has accused you. We need to work out a solution with your accuser quickly. And he literally says, on the way. On the way, I guess, to court. Disputes that aren't handled quickly, they can get out of hand. And it should be handled before you have to go to court. Settle it in any way you can before the judge makes his decision is what he's saying here. On the way to court, literally. But after the judge makes a decision, then there's no changing anything. Then there's no changing the law. The judge would give his sentence. He would hand over the accused to the officer. And then he would place him in prison. And that was the end of that. In verse 26, truly I say unto you, thou shalt by no means come out thence till you have paid the uttermost farthing. So once the judge made his decision, once you've been placed in prison, there's no coming out until you've paid the debt that you owe, every cent. So it'd be much better to work it out quickly before it goes that far. All right. Verse 27. Now we're getting into the fun stuff. I'm kind of scattered tonight because I worked and barely got home in time enough to grab my notes. Didn't have time to look over them. But we'll do the best we can. In verse 27, he says, you have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. This was the seventh of the Ten Commandments. We find it in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 14. What was the punishment for both parties that committed adultery under the Old Testament? Stoning to death. Leviticus 20 and verse 10, Deuteronomy 22 verses 22 through 27. They had obviously heard, they obviously knew God's law concerning the physical act of adultery. But again, Jesus is going to go back to the thoughts that lead up to adultery, that precede adultery. In verse 28, but he says, but I say unto you that whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart, or you might say in his mind. And so he makes a clear contrast between what they heard in the law and what he is saying. The law only dealt with a literal physical act of adultery. But now Jesus is going deeper than that. Now he's going to deal with their heart. And notice he says, whosoever. This applies to anyone. Whosoever looketh on a woman, notice to lust after her. To lust after. Not just looking at someone and noticing that they're handsome or noticing that they have beauty, but looking on a woman to lust after her. Notice he says, has already committed adultery with her in his heart or in his mind. It's a look to lust after her, or a look to lust after him. Women could do the same thing. So just simply restraining from the physical act is not enough. If we are to fantasize in our minds or to desire to do those things in our minds, God knows the heart, and it is sinful to do that. To lust for the physical act in the mind is to commit adultery in the mind. To fantasize about it is to commit it in the heart. And of course, what can that eventually lead to? Actually physically committing the act. So we have to stop even the thoughts, before any physical sin takes place. If you have a desire to commit a physical act, a sinful act, but you just don't get caught or nobody knows, it's wrong. God knows. You're sinning in your heart. You're sinning in your mind. If you just never get the chance, but you would if you could, if you didn't get caught. God knows what's in your heart, and you've committed that act in your heart. You've committed it in your mind. And we have to make sure that we keep even our thoughts pure at all times. Philippians 4, verses 8 and 9. Look there if you would. Philippians 4, verses 8 and 9. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are honest, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. And those things which you have both learned and received and heard and seen in me do, and the God of peace shall be with you. We've got to keep our hearts, got to keep our minds pure. Otherwise, are we not just like the Pharisees and the Sadducees? We appear to be very clean on the outside, but what's going on the inside? What's going on in our minds and in our hearts? Do we have that problem today? What's a major problem today? Pornography? Is pornography available today? So easily able to access pornography on the internet. When I was a young boy, you had to find a magazine somewhere. But not today. You just have a cell phone and you can find it. And it's a huge problem.
I read one time called about the three A's of sin: availability, affordability, and anonymity. Yeah. Can you be anonymous in doing it? Pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
Is it available? It's everywhere. And is it affordable? It's it comes up, pops up on your phone, or
Yeah.
Computer for free.
And I don't have a problem with it ever popping up on any of the stuff that I have, but I had a friend who's a Christian now, but he did look at it, I guess, for a while, and he got rid of one computer and tried to get it out and got a brand new computer, and still he has trouble with it popping up. It's like once he looked at it, he just can't get away from it now.
Tied to your email, I guess.
Yeah. I think he tried changing everything and it still pops up. It's strange. Can't get away from it. Now, adultery in the heart, is that grounds for divorce? No. I don't believe it is. We'll see what constitutes grounds for divorce. Matthew chapter 5 and Matthew chapter 19. About to look at that right here. So let's go and begin in verse 29. If your right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members shall perish, and not that your whole body be cast into hell. If your right hand offend you, cut it off and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that your whole body should be cast into hell. Now, what's the context here? It's committing adultery in the heart. Your eyes and your hands are obviously very important parts of your body, especially your right hand. Strong hand, your right eye. So what's the point here that Jesus is making? What point is he making here?
You have to get rid of those things that cause you to sin.
Yeah. Whatever causes you to sin, you need to get rid of it, whatever it is. Is he teaching self-mutilation? No. But do we take these verses literally? Because I've heard people saying, you know, we don't take these verses literally. Well, I do take them literally. But I don't believe he's teaching self-mutilation, because do the eyes and the hands literally cause us to sin? No. If they did, you'd be a lot better off taking them out, right? But they don't cause us to sin. So he's basically saying, whatever causes you to sin, get rid of it. Whatever causes you to sin, it must be removed, whatever it is. It's much better to remove whatever's causing the offense than to burn in hell forever. So think about that. If anything's causing you to stumble, if anything's bringing evil thoughts, tempting you, get rid of it. The word here for hell, again, is Gehenna. Again, from the Valley of Hinnom. The Jews under the law put adulteresses to death. They were taken to a spot that was overhanging the Valley of Hinnom, overhanging Gehenna. And they would literally cast them down onto a rock. And the second witness would throw a great stone down upon their chest. And if they were still alive, the spectators would continue to stone them until they were